Hi, I'm Neil Denny, and you're about to listen to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm in Oakland in California, just across the bay from San Francisco, and I'm about to visit the National Center for Science Education to talk with Eugenie Scott. Eugenie Scott is Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. She has written extensively on the evolution-creationism controversy and is a past president of the American Association of Physical Anthropologists. She's also the author of Evolution versus Creationism, an Introduction, from the University of California Press. Eugenie, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Well, I'm delighted to see you. Thank you for coming.
Let's talk about, first of all, where we are. We're in your office in the National Center for Science Education. So let's talk about this organization and what it's about.
This is an organization that was started over 25 years ago now, started actually back in the early 80s by scientists and teachers who were very concerned because at the time there was legislation being submitted all over the country that would require that if you taught evolution, you had to teach something called creation science to balance it out. And creation science, of course, was nonsense scientifically, but it was very appealing to many religious conservatives. So these bills needed to be stopped. And scientists and teachers would get together to try to stop these bills in state legislatures around the country. Part of this anti-evolution movement of the time involved problems at school board levels as well. And I had gotten involved as a college professor in Lexington, Kentucky, at the University of Kentucky there, in a school board level controversy back in 1981, where the Lexington school board had been approached by some local citizens who wanted this wonderful new science taught to the Lexington students. And of course, the scientists up on campus didn't think that was a very good idea at all. So it was problems like that that generated the interest in the science community to try to get organized around the country. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it was the same bill, by and large. So why should every state have to invent its own strategy? We called ourselves at the time the Committees of Correspondence, which is a distinctly American referent having to do with the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. You guys were part of that, I remember.
Yeah, I guess so.
Back
we didn't
in the
come
day.
Out too well.
Oh, I don't know. Just depends on how you look at it, right? But the Committees of Correspondence were the old colonial groups who mm-hmm. corresponded about the actions of the British. So, you know, we would make jokes about the creationists are coming, the creationists are coming. So it was decided that rather than everybody having to invent this same solution over and over, those of us who had to deal with creationism, either on a local level like our group in Lexington or on a state level, could share, you know, what are the arguments that work best. Mm-hmm. Mostly the concern was that this was politics, right? And what do college professors, what do scientists and teachers know about politics? Mm-hmm. Nothing, I mean, basically. So a lot of what the Committees of Correspondence did is correspond with each other about how do you make an effective presentation to a school board? You know, because that's not something that scientists especially are knowledgeable mm-hmm. about. How do you organize at the grassroots level? So out of this informal Committee of Correspondence came the realization that, you know, this problem isn't going to go away. And even if these bills are eventually stopped in the court, which we certainly hope would be the case, the problems of teaching evolution are going to continue. Mm-hmm. They had been extant up until then, and they weren't going to get any better with all this legislation and all the fuss and bother that was generated. So the group of people organizing, you know, associated with the Committees of Correspondence, especially a man named Stan Weinberg, organized and incorporated the National Center for Science Education. Sometimes people ask me, well, why is that such a broad term? Why not the mm-hmm. National Center for Fighting Creationism or something like that? And it's because the board of directors thought back then that teachers and scientists working together is a really strong combination. And after the creationist issue is taken care of, right? Yeah. Then we'll continue working together, et cetera. Well, that didn't happen. Creationist issue is still with us 25 plus years later.
At that time, I mean, did you think that was going to be the case?
There was no.
Any possibility that...
I don't think so, no.
Yeah.
So we were incorporated in 83.
Yeah.
And then I actually sort of didn't really have a whole lot to do with the organization thereafter for a few years. And Stan Weinberg went around and managed to get private foundation money to actually open a national office. And turned out I was between jobs at the time. And when I saw the advertisement for the executive director of the National Center for Science Education, I thought, whoa, I bet I could do that. And here I am. Fortunately, the board of directors also thought I could do that, so they hired me.
We'll talk about this in more detail later, but you're broadening the remit in that you're looking at climate change education as well. So we'll actually get into the meat of that. So clearly there is, you know, even though creationism is still with us.
Finally, we're living up to our name, you know. Yeah. It works for me. I'm delighted.
Okay, so let's go really back to basics, and apologies for this, but let's talk about what we mean by creationism, mm-hmm. let's say. Because we talk about evolution on the show all the time. So let's go back to basics and talk about creationism.
Well, creationism is a term that's defined in different ways. The most frequent definition of creationism is Christian special creationism, which is the idea that God creates things in essentially their present form as we see them today. And special creationism is a very strong part of biblical literalist interpretations of Christianity. Now, the most common form of special creationism that we find is young earth special creationism, the idea of the 6 24-hour days, the really strict literal interpretation of Genesis. But there's also something called progressive creationism, which is actually more interesting, mm-hmm. I think. And this is the idea that God creates across time.
Mm-hmm.
So the fossil record's real. I mean, it really does show a sequence of organisms that lived at different times. And progressive creationists generally accept an old earth. That's not a problem. Earth can be millions or billions of years old. That's not a big deal for them. But biological evolution, they reject. The idea of common ancestors for living things is something they cannot accept, mm-hmm. because it says in the Bible that God created specially the kinds of organisms, of plants and animals. So they have to stick to that. So God just created these kinds of organisms, and what we see is pretty much their present form, sequentially over time.
Mm-hmm.
So he created fish before he created amphibians, that sort of thing.
Sure. Okay, so then the other phrase that everybody will know is intelligent design,
mm-hmm.
which I suppose we can talk later again about the way that that has been used specifically as a political tool, but what's the definition of that?
Well, there's an intermediate stage that you get, a fossil link, as it were.
A missing link.
Creationism is, you know, is a religious idea.
Yeah.
But something called creation science was, in American history, from about the 60s or so on, a very important movement in which they took the special creationist religious view, the biblical literalist view, especially the young earth form, and tried to claim that there was scientific evidence and warrant for demonstrating it. So it wasn't just true because the Bible said it was true because science said it was true. And of course, that's a kind of a peculiarly American kind of enthusiasm, partly because of our Constitution, which does not allow for the advocacy of religious views in the public schools. So since you can't teach straight-up creationism in the public schools, you could teach, they thought, they hoped, they planned, you could teach an alternative science.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the deal with creation science. And creation science bubbled along quite nicely up until the end of the 1980s, when a Supreme Court decision said, no, this is religious advocacy, you can't legally teach this subject in the public schools. And it was around that time that a new form of creationism began to emerge. It had been around since the early 80s, really, but it wasn't until the late 80s that intelligent design, as it's identifiable as the present-day intelligent design movement, really came on the scene. And I'm up to answering your question. But it's important to know about creation science first, because intelligent design really is a subset of creation science.
Right.
It is an effort to demonstrate special creation, but in a very subtle and really quite hidden way. Whereas the young earth creationists are just straight up about God goes poof, you know, and creates things in their present form. The intelligent design people bury that, mm-hmm. considerably further. Where intelligent design comes from is the failure, really, of creation science. Failure on two levels. One failure, the failure to meet the legal requirements of the United States. And the second failure, though, is a failure to become generally attractive to American Christians, mm-hmm. who, by and large, really aren't biblical literalists. You know, I mean, Catholics and mainstream Protestants don't think the earth had to be created in 6 24-hour days. And so the intelligent design movement was searching for some anti-evolution position, so to speak, that wouldn't make the same mistakes as the creation science people did. And the biggest mistake that creation science made was making too many fact claims, like the age of the earth,
mm-hmm.
Being only a few thousand years old, or like in the sense of the Institute for Creation Research version, which is the most popular version, flood geology, as they call it, that all sedimentary deposits of the whole planet, everything from the Himalayas to the, you know, Death Valley, are the result of Noah's flood. That's a lot of sedimentation, mm-hmm. right? It's not really geologically very likely. So if you avoid those kinds of fact claims, you are less legally vulnerable. But you also are more attractive in general mm-hmm. to the Christian population, which might think that some of these other ideas are a little out there. So intelligent design emerged as a way of concentrating on what is most important to conservative Christians when it comes to evolution. And that's the design argument. That's the idea that there's such incredible complexity out there in nature, especially in biology, that it can't possibly be explained by natural forces, like natural selection.
Mm-hmm.
So their view is that you've got these really, really complex things, improbable things in nature, irreducibly complex things, as Michael Behe refers to them, which require an intelligence to explain. They don't say the intelligence is God, because once you use the G word, you can't be taught in American schools. That's religious advocacy, so they have to kind of bury God beneath the idea of an intelligence. We're not saying what it is, might be God, might be something else. No, of course, it's God.
Well, we could make the argument that it could be a race of superintelligent aliens. Mm. One would then have to argue who created those superintelligent aliens, of course.
It's turtles all the way down. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you get into that problem. But they generally, you know, it's funny. There's a group in Canada, followers of a charismatic fellow named Rael, R-A-E-L. Mm-hmm. If you Google the Raelians, you'll get many giggles. But the Raelians have their own cosmology, so to speak, mm-hmm. their own creation story about super, super intelligent aliens who supposedly came to Earth and seeded Earth and has been sort of manipulating the genomes and all this other kind of wacko stuff.
It's a lot more plausible, though.
Yeah, because at least it's a material explanation. But it's funny, you know, the guys at the Discovery Institute weren't happy at all when, you know, people started proposing, well, okay, we can teach evolution and then we'll balance that out with teaching Raelianism. And that gives you an alternative. They weren't happy.
Let's have a look at perhaps one of the... Give us an example of something that's irreducibly complex.
Well, I'll give you what the intelligent design people think.
That's what
not
I mean.
What I think. It's their concept,
yeah,
friend,
yeah.
Not mine. The poster child for intelligent design is the bacterial flagellum,
mm-hmm.
this little motor of the bacterial flagellum that makes it whip around and move the bacterium around in liquid. And supposedly, this little motor consists of about 50 different proteins. It's really a very slick little engine. There's no question about it. But engine is not a description. It is an analogy. It is a metaphor. It's not really an engine. And I think a major problem that the ID people have is this idea that you can somehow equate biological structures to human artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
It's the artifactual error that they make. Michael Behe, who's one of the major intelligent design proponents, even referred to biological structures as a purposeful arrangement of parts, which, of course, is what a machine is, what mm-hmm. a human artifact is. We're surrounded by purposeful arrangements of parts, including this lovely little recorder that you have here and my computer that's humming in the background, and there's lots of purposeful arrangements of parts. None of them reproduce. All right, that's the big difference mm-hmm. between a biological structure and something like your recorder here. We could trace the, quote, evolution of your recorder to simpler recorders, but I think that's kind of dumb and it really confuses people about what evolution is. If we ever get one of these little gizmos that can actually reproduce itself, then we can talk about evolution. But lacking reproduction, you're not really talking about biology. And, of course, you know, this idea that there is such a thing as irreducible complexity really is a very weak scientific idea, because it is based upon the idea that because we cannot currently explain something that's really complex, there is no natural explanation. And that really kind of gets to another major reason why scientists are so leery of intelligent design, is that it sort of undercuts the whole philosophy that we scientists hold, which is that, well, just because we can't understand it today, we're going to keep working on it. Maybe tomorrow we'll understand it. Or maybe 10 years mm-hmm. from now, or maybe 50 years from now. I mean, you don't just throw up your hands and say, too tough, I'm going to quit. Not a good scientific approach. But this is basically what the concept of irreducible complexity is all about. It's, I don't understand how this works, therefore I'm not going to bother trying to find a natural explanation. It's just too improbable, too complicated.
It's interesting, though, that of all the wonders in the universe of human beings, consciousness, amazing animals, the flagellum of a bacterium is God's crowning achievement.
I don't know that they would...
That's the thing he's most proud of.
I'm not sure that they would necessarily view it that way, but I'm sure it's partly the function of Michael Behe, who is one of the few scientists who really embraced this view, being himself a biochemist and looking at things in the subcellular level. But that said, the definition of an irreducibly complex structure is one that if you take away one component, it doesn't work, that all parts have to be together at the same time for the gizmo to work. I'm sure there may be one or two parts of your recording device over here that I could take away and it would still work, but we'd get down to an irreducible complexity here where if I take something away, you're not going to record anything. That's the general idea. So the purposeful arrangement of parts, human artifactual analogy kind of thing works here too. So with the claim that something is irreducibly complex ignores a number of ways in which we do understand natural selection works. And you don't have to have natural selection of every single individual, one of those 50 proteins, for example, for the bacteria flagellum, one at a time in order for them to, in order to get a final functioning structure. But the point is that I was leading to it before I got distracted, happens all the time, is that there are other structures which are just as irreducibly complex. A colleague of mine who was our postdoc here, Alan Gishlick, is a specialist in dinosaur anatomy, and he writes about the wrist of birds, the avian wrist. If you look at the wrist of birds, which of course is a major component of the wing, bones of the bird's wing having to, you know, rely upon certain kinds of motions of the wrist joint, you'll find that if you remove even one of those bones and ligaments, your bird can't fly. It just sits there on the ground watching out for cats. So it's an irreducibly complex structure. But we actually know through the fossil record how that structure evolved. So even if today it's irreducibly complex, that doesn't mean that an irreducibly complex structure could not have evolved. There's no fossil record for the bacteria flagellum. Okay, we have a record in one sense by looking at all the different kinds of, because there's more than one bacteria flagellum. There's a lot of different bacteria left, a lot of different kinds of structures that go into the flagellum. And we, in one sense, we can look at kind of a fossil record in that regard, and that has been done, which refutes the argument of that. But by and large, it's not as clean as when you've got morphological structures. The mammalian middle ear. You take out one of those bones and, you know, you don't hear very well. You could put your chin on the ground and pick up vibrations like a snake, but you're not going to hear like you hear, right? We know from the fossil record exactly how that evolved. So we know there are some so-called irreducibly complex structures that do have evolutionary histories. You know, why would we assume that something like the bacteria flagellum could not evolve? But they have a wonderful facility of picking out those examples which are not yet solved.
But also, as you said, that where there is no easy-to-go-to fossil record, you know, it's something that's an example. So I wonder if perhaps we can just speculate for a while. I'm interested in where these ideas originally came from. You sort of mentioned, or you alluded to the fact earlier, that it's a peculiarly American idea, right? The mainstream church, the Anglican church, the Catholic church in Europe does not think this way, does not have any problem with evolution. You know, we could look back at the American fundamentalist movement, which, named after, you know, going back to the fundamentals of the Bible, it almost pays a compliment to science in that this only started happening after Darwinism, after we started to look at life, the rise of life, through a scientific lens. Before, religion was a myth. It was, you know, myths and stories, and that was the way it was interpreted by its adherents. Suddenly, it's only in the 20th century that it's seen to be something that you can look at through the lens of science.
Maybe, but I think we sort of are talking about two things at once here, I think. Why in the United States was sort of the first issue that you were bringing up. And I think it's directly a result of the history of religion here, as opposed to in Great Britain and Europe. And we have had a very different religious history, including the rise of the fundamentalist movement in Protestantism, which came about around the time of World War I, which was a terrifically gut-wrenching experience in Europe, Great Britain, and the United States. I mean, this is horrible thing. and a great response against, quote, modernism, in the sense that here the Germans were supposed to be this incredibly advanced culture, and wow, look at the terrible things they did, and so forth and so on. So, you know, well, maybe, you know, maybe modern culture isn't that great. Maybe we should go back to our roots, and, you know, and that those were sorts some of the feelings that helped to stimulate the fundamentalist movement, much more so than an anti-science or even an anti-evolution. The evolution just kind of got folded in. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at these pamphlets that form the basis of fundamentalism, they're a series of 12 pamphlets called the 12 Fundamentals, which were commissioned by some wealthy business people in Southern California to be, you know, by... They got some conservative Christian scholars to write these 12 booklets and then combine them all into a single volume. But the booklets really are not especially anti-evolutionary. The anti-evolution stuff kind of grew up later in the 20s, time of the Scopes trial and so forth. So the decentralized nature of American Christianity is very important in why we got it and you guys didn't. So we have a much more conservative form of Protestantism here than you find on the mm-hmm. continent. Or in Great Britain. That said, you guys better look over your shoulder.
Yeah, no, certainly.
You know, it's growing.
Yeah, it's growing. No, absolutely. But it's, again, it's very much seen as a fringe movement in the UK and Europe thing. But no, you're absolutely right. We need to be vigilant on that.
And if I just may, because this is a UK production here, I visited the UK a couple of times, and in talking to some of the science education people there, there is a real concern that the classroom teachers aren't anti-evolutionary. I mean, Darwin's your guy, right? I mean, it's not like there's this feeling that evolution is wrong. But it is the case that there's not very much understanding of it. And that in teacher training, the science education that your future teachers get when they're at the university isn't focusing sufficiently upon evolution to the degree that those teachers, when they go out to teach, feel comfortable teaching it. So a kid comes up and they've got some literature from either the American Christian Creation Science Groups or Harun Yahya's Islamic, which is the same thing, basically. Mm-hmm. Kid comes up with some anti-evolution materials and your teachers don't know how to handle it. So they just skip evolution because it's easier than saying, I don't know. And we find that same thing going on here in the U.S. So word to the wise, don't make the mistake we did. You know, do a better job training your science teachers so that they really understand evolution and its importance in biology and geology.
So this is a really great point then, apart from teaching our science teachers better. What else can we do?
It has a huge trickle-down effect.
So let's talk about the work of the National Center for Science Education. What then are you guys doing to combat this?
Well, you know, there is a British Center for Science Education. There's a non-profit group, our equivalent of a non-profit group, a non-governmental group in Great Britain that basically tries to do the same thing that we do, which is to help people at the grassroots level when these problems arise. They'd be worthwhile for you to talk to and interview sometime, because when I was in Great Britain last, a couple of years ago, I was talking to some of these guys, and they were telling me examples of the sort of calls they get, and they're very similar to what we get here. It's a teacher who, you know, is being told by a supervisor, well, you know, we've got all these conservative Christian kids, or we've got these Muslim kids, and they really don't want to hear about evolution, so can you just skip it? And that's happening today. So what can parents do? Support teachers. That's what we tell people here. I suspect that would be true back home for you, too. The point being that it's very easy. I mean, teachers are... This is a service profession, okay? Teachers are people who want to teach kids. That's why they got into the job. They didn't get in the job to fight battles with parents or administrators or kids or what. You know, they just want to share the joy of learning, right? And so they may be, not in all cases, obviously, I'm generalizing here, but teachers may be reluctant to get into contentious arguments with parents or administrators or somebody else. So it needs to be made clear by citizens, especially if you have kids in the schools, you're going to the the whatever in America you call it back to school night, but you know you're meeting with the teacher to find out what's going on in your students in your child's classroom and stuff. Just make it really clear to the teacher that you want good science to be taught, and you will back that teacher if anybody gives the teacher any difficulties about teaching good science, which is evolution. That's important to do because most of the time the teachers hear from the antis. They very rarely hear from the pros, anti-evolution versus pro-evolution. Mm-hmm. And everything really depends on the teacher. It really does. Because it's real easy for a teacher to just not quite to get to that chapter because we were too rushed.
I want to spend some time looking at some of the court cases that have happened and what tends to happen when parents or the school board try to encourage the teaching of creation science or intelligent design or whatever alongside evolution. But first of all, and of course it's a really obvious question which you must get asked time and time again, but I don't think it's so obvious to parents. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with teaching evolution and creationism side by side in a science class?
There's nothing wrong with teaching evolution and creationism, but they shouldn't be side by side, and they definitely shouldn't be in science class. If you teach them in science class, the assumption is that they are equivalent sciences. They aren't. One is a religious view, one is a scientific view. And at that, there's more than one religious view. I mean, when people say we should be teaching creation and evolution, I say, which creationism? Because there's a long list, and I can give you a real long list, because I've studied this, right? Yeah, whose creationism?
We could be teaching the Hindu creation myth.
So. Which one?
Yeah.
There's more than one Hindu creation myth, just like there's more than one Christian view. And boy, when we start in on Native Americans or Sub-Saharan Africans, we can really go to town. There's all kinds of stuff. So I am personally of the belief that in America anyway, in the United States, we really need a lot more religious literacy. People might know a little bit about their own denomination's views, and when it comes to Catholics, generally not even that unless you go to Catholic school. But most Protestants don't know the full range of Lutherans don't know what Baptists believe, Baptists don't know what Methodists believe, people don't know. So it would be a very good thing, I think, if we were to have some comparative religion in American schools.
But of course, there's the separation of church and state. So.
As long as it's not advocacy of religion, this is why you make it comparative religion. Mm-hmm. So you talk about different views of within Christianity. You talk about, pick out some Native American stories. And of course, if you're going to, I mean, I would like to see religion, comparative religion, not just comparative creationism. Creation stories are just one piece of religion, and actually not even a very important piece. One of the things that I think many American atheists don't really understand is that religion is not primarily about explaining the natural world. And this is not really why, you know, people don't read the Bible because they want to know how Grand Canyon was formed, mm-hmm. right? So just understanding why is religion a cultural universal? Why has every culture that anthropologists have ever encountered in time or at one time, at our time, why has every human culture had some sort of concept of the supernatural, of some sort of non-material reality that you can communicate with in some fashion, gods or ancestor spirits or something? What is that doing? Doesn't mean that it's true, doesn't mean that it's false, but it does mean that it's important because it's really part of, it's an extremely easily learned behavior, shall we say. So we should know more about it.
And that seems eminently sensible idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just from the basis of teaching people comparative religions, but also just because so much of all other cultures have a comparative literature, for instance. A lot of old literature is an art, is unintelligible without some sort understanding of religion.
Especially in Western Europe.
Mm-hmm. So I'd be interested to know, what is the religious conservatives' view about teaching comparative religions?
They're dead set against it.
And why is that?
Because they don't want their true beliefs being held up comparatively against all these myths and pagan confusions. And they don't want their children being misled. And, you know, I mean, I personally don't think the goal of comparative religion is to turn children away from religion. That's not the point. And I also think it's very important that you do this at an age when students are old enough and intellectually mature enough so that they can actually stand back and have some sense of detachment from these, this, you know, you wouldn't do it in junior high. That's a bad age. But, you know, junior, senior level in high school, when kids are older, there's at least some ability to reason abstractly and to look at these issues more dispassionately, so that you can look at something like a Hopi creation myth and a Navajo creation myth and look at the similarities and differences, and what is the meaning of this myth, and why is it, you know, what is it about the Hopi culture and the Navajo culture that is reflected in this myth? And then it becomes possible to make that same kind of reflection with more familiar religions, including the world religions. That doesn't necessarily mean that you give up your faith, but that's the big fear of the Christians.
But wouldn't it? There's something delicious about the idea of lots of school children suddenly going home and, "Mum, Dad, I'm going to become a Hopi."
Yeah. I don't think so. But, you know, I think the big fear is that students will see, wow, here are cultures all over the world who feel just as strongly about the truth of their particular beliefs as I do about my Baptist belief or Methodist belief. Or Unitarian beliefs, or, yeah. They can't all be right.
Or even how many of those different religions share the same beliefs. So a story, for instance, the obvious one is the story of the flood, yeah. Noah.
Yeah.
And to see
yeah.
how that yeah. is represented in so many old Middle Eastern religions mm-hmm. is fascinating.
Well, but see, depending on how you look at that, mm. that could be proof that it's really true.
Mm, this is
it's
true,
it's just,
yeah.
you know, diffusion
yeah.
of the idea,
mm.
as opposed to diffusion of the idea. But, yeah, the thing that drives me crazy about that is conservative Christians will look at things like flood myths among American Indians. And there's this, aha, look, here's a flood myth among the Sioux of North Dakota or the Plains Indians, which they, trust me, there's never been a flood in any sort of, you know, since they came to North America. This hasn't happened, not in the Great Plains states. And they'll say, see, that's, you know, proof that the Noah story of the Bible is true. Forgetting the fact that these people were missionized back in the 1700s and 1800s, and there's this wonderful kind of syncretism of their traditional mm-hmm. native beliefs and this new Christian missionary belief, and it sort of all gets wound in together. And, you know, you can see the bones of the flood story in there, but it's all kind of mixed up with the traditional ones. But it is, nonetheless, a syncretism. It is not the fact that they actually had a flood back then or that their folk tales talk about floods. It's diffusion, but in a very different fashion. But yeah, no, I think a big fear that religious conservatives have of comparative religion is that kids will say, all these religions can't be right, maybe none of them are right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their big fear.
I mentioned I wanted to talk about some of the court cases. Let's think about mm-hmm. Let's talk about an example. For instance, you know, there was the most recent one I can think of is the Dover, Pennsylvania mm-hmm. one.
That is the most recent one.
What happens when they try to get this through the school board?
The Dover case was a local school board level issue. Some of the other court cases had to do with state legislation. But Dover was one, and some of the other cases have to do with individual teachers. So there's a whole gamut of court cases. The Dover case was one that came up after many years of contention over the teaching of evolution. This wasn't something that just sprang up over ID. The Dover school board had been kind of beating up against evolution for 5 or 6 years. You know, we had a file on these guys. We were kind of watching this from a distance. There were these little incidents that kind of cropped up where it was clear that there were conservatives on the school board that were very wary of how evolution was being taught, and teachers who were feeling a little bit inhibited about teaching. And
mm-hmm.
So finally, they got a critical majority of people on the board, and they got a leader who was really passionate about the topic of evolution. And then there was some outside agitation, so to speak, in the sense that a outside group, this Michigan organization, the Thomas More Foundation, was actually looking for a test case and corresponded with members of the Dover board to try to plant this idea that they should be teaching intelligent design. And, oh, look, here's this textbook of pandas and people that you can introduce. So the first fight was over the introduction of Pandas and People, which is a supplement to the normal high school biology book that's mm-hmm. written by the ID proponents. And the idea is you'll have your regular high school biology textbook written by a commercial publisher, and then you'll also have pandas and people. And that will help to balance it out, because pandas is sort of saying this other stuff is wrong and promoting the intelligent design view. So the teachers took one look at this book and thought, no way we're going to use this. So there was this big fight about how to force the teachers to use it, and you know, this other kind. And the teachers kept trying to compromise, and you know, bless their hearts, they were being like teachers. They were trying to, you know, get along and maybe resolve this problem. Maybe we give a little, you guys will give a little. The board never gave a little. The board just stuck to its guns. Finally, something of a compromise was made, that the books, rather than being in the classroom, would be in the school library, but then basically the librarian thought they were junk and didn't put them out either. So then the school board got all mad at the teachers and librarians and just passed this policy about how evolution should be taught. And basically, you know, students were supposed to be taught intelligent design, and mention of pandas being available in the library. And so at that point, the teachers finally just had it. And actually, several of them were plaintiffs in the case, which is very unusual. Mm-hmm. So there was quite a long line, actually, of people willing to be plaintiffs in Dover, which was great. So that case was quite an experience, believe me. As you know, we advised the plaintiff's legal team and helped put it together, and recommended the expert witnesses and helped to prepare the expert witnesses, although obviously our expert witnesses were so good, we didn't have to do a lot, but we worked with them. And when the whole experience was almost a full year, over a full year, come to think of it, because we actually started, I think the first filings were in November or December of 2004. And then the actual case wasn't tried until the summer of 2005, after all the depositions and all the other stuff the preliminary discovery stuff you have to do in a trial. The depositions were in the summer. The trial was in the fall of 2005. And then the judge's decision was in December of 2005. So that was all pretty quick once we got rolling. But it was quite an experience. And the judge, after a full trial where the ID perspective was very well represented, I mean, many of their expert witnesses bailed, but they did, in terms of the science, they had the two strongest science people that they could have had. They had Behe, and they had, the guy from Idaho. The name is not coming to my brain right now. It'll come. But those are probably the two most solid scientists that are in the ID stable. Everybody else is a lawyer or a philosopher of science or a historian or something like that. But those two guys are real bona fide published scientists. Mm-hmm. So if they can't make the sale, nobody can. So they didn't. And they didn't make the sale partly because we knew what they were going to say, and our people did a very good job of showing why these views were not scientific. We were very good, and they just didn't have a good position. So the upshot was the judge decided, okay, intelligent design is not a scientific position. It is definitely a religious position. There is the way the American law works, the First Amendment interpretation, is that in order to be legal to teach, in order for a policy to be legal to not violate the First Amendment, it has to have a secular purpose and neither advance nor impede religion. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're dealing with the advancement, the Establishment Clause in this case. And it was clear that since ID wasn't science, and since the fact claims it made were wrong, there's really no secular reason to teach it. The only reason to teach it is to advance a religious doctrine. So therefore, he struck it down.
One final question then. And I said we were going to talk about the fact that you're now sort of covering climate change science. That's sort of relevant to this last question. While I'm here travelling across the US, it's the election year. We're leading up to an election, and I'm interested in talking about how particularly has a bearing on science.
Yeah.
And clearly both of these things, both the teaching of, you know, the teaching of creationism and the climate change, are things that are political hot potatoes. So to what extent is the coming election critical for both of these things, I guess?
You know, the thing that needs to be understood about American education and American politics is that we have a very, very decentralized education system. Decisions are made at the local school district level, maybe at the state level, and there's some correspondence between the two. But curriculum issues are almost always at the local and state level. I mean, there's just no curriculum issue at the federal level. Mm-hmm. evolution and creationism ultimately are curricular issues. So any politician running for the Senate, the House, the presidency, you ask any of these people, you know, should we teach this, should we teach that, they'll all say, defer to the locals. They'll pass that buck right on back. And actually, it's appropriate because really there's hardly anything that the president can do to ensure that evolution is taught properly. I mean, that's just not, you know, on his to-do list. But that said, when Bush, too, was elected to his second term, especially, religious conservatives really were energized by that. They just thought this was great. It was a validation. And so they did become much more active in trying to push their local agendas at the state and local level, including creationism. And, you know, that is always a possibility, that if more conservative candidates at the state or local level are elected, that may increase the local pressure. But the national election has very little to do with my issue.
So what about the issue of climate science?
With climate science also, because what to teach in terms of global warming, say, or other climate science elements, is largely a local issue. And I think climate science research, climate science policy, what should we do about global warming? Should we have cap and trade? Should we have a carbon tax? I mean, all those kinds of big picture policy issues are issues that will be going on at the national level. But they aren't going to affect the local curriculum very much, if at all, only in sort of a very distant fashion, in that the people who are against climate change will be rallying against these policy issues, and that will have more publicity for the view that climate change really is just a hoax, as opposed to mainstream science view.
Eugenie, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Well, it's been great fun. Thank you for being interested in these topics.
I'm Kevin Hand. That was a Little Adams Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow Neil on his fantastic trip on Twitter @LittleAdams. And thanks for listening.